You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Andorra.
Something like, where were you when I needed you so badly? Nobody's better than anyone else, but still, you thought that you had won. If I cried before your door, it was worth nothing. I just spent time in the bar, wasting my love. So everyone thought that this was a love song, but actually, it was written against their promoters. They only explained that a handful of years ago.
Beautiful. Well, we were played in by some beautiful singing there, and we'll explain that in a moment. But where are we, Lionel?
We're in Andorra, the worst place in Europe. It's a terrible city. It's surrounded by beautiful mountains. But at some point, somebody thought, I know, why don't we build lots of tall buildings so no one can see the wonderful view?
That was Lionel Burney. This is Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Charles. I only showed up tonight to listen to Lionel's inevitable tirade about Andorra. I knew it was coming. Also showed up because podcasting is one of the only forms of communication in Andorra. Impossible to text, impossible to call anyone without taking out a second mortgage. So, Mum, I'm fine. I'll be in touch in a couple of days. Hope you're doing well. Say hi to Dad for me.
Your mum listens to the podcast.
Doubt it. No one in the Free family listens to the podcast.
Oh, I was waiting for that. You beat me to it.
Well, listen, and Fran Reyes, you're here, and it was your lovely voice that played us in.
Yeah, no, it wasn't lovely, man. I have been without that voice for, I don't know, 3-4 days. Now I am still recovering. I can't sing properly a bolero or a rock song.
Well, I think you are a bit frustrated because we secretly recorded you in the car today. You have been entertaining us with your beautiful singing voice the last couple of days. So we thought we'd secretly record you today, and I know you're a bit shocked to be played in by that. But maybe we'll re-record you in a couple of days. You can have another go.
Of course, I will practice so hard these days, and I'm going to disappoint nor you or the listeners.
Well, something to look forward to, isn't it?
To be honest, Fran's singing is the only thing that stopped me being car sick at one point today. I was just concentrating on the singing as we were going up a twisty road in the mountains. It was a tough day for a journalist travelling in the back of a small car, I think, today. Somebody asked me on Twitter what we're travelling around the Vuelta in. In the past, we've had a Jaguar at the Tour de France. We've had a Maserati at the Giro d'Italia. This year...
Whoa, look at this.
Oh, well, we're standing next to a little car turning circle. We could have done with that a little bit earlier when we were trying to park in that underground car park. But yeah, we are traveling with Fran's friend and colleague, Victor, in his, it's a very comfortable little Ford Focus, but it does feel a little bit like a student road trip, doesn't it? Fran's handing out the rice cakes at just to make sure I don't go hungry. That's much appreciated. Carry that on. Yeah, there's no air con. You know, I'm a sort of pasty British person. It's very warm here. I have to get the windows open. And like I say, today, my stomach was doing somersaults.
You also had to go for a run this morning, didn't you, Lionel? Because we thought the start was at 1:15. The start was at 1 o'clock. We were on the verge of missing the little window before the start to drive in front of the race. And I phoned Lionel, and next thing I felt the earth kind of juddering beneath my feet. Boom, boom, boom. And there was Lionel appearing around the corner.
I did about 1,800 metres in around 3:50.
Absolute nonsense. Anyway, Lionel, it was a thrilling stage today. We've got a lot to talk about from the stage, so please give us the tale of it, please.
I will. Stage 3 to Andorra La Vella, 158 kilometres. There was an early break, and Richard Moore, you predicted that Thomas de Gendt would be in that break for Lotto Soudal, and he was. I mean, you're basically Nostradamus.
What powers of divination. Incredible.
Well, I mean, you use the evidence available. He'd done well here before in the Tour de France on these roads. And, he got...
Never won a Stage of the Vuelta, and it's the thing that he really wants to do. And he wants to win an iconic stage. I'm not sure if Andorra would have counted, but, of course, he's won Mont Ventoux. He's won in the Stelvio. So at the Giro, so the one missing is the Vuelta.
It is. Well, maybe he'll win on the Angliru. Who knows, at the end of the race. Anyway, that's skipping 3 weeks ahead. De Gendt was in there with David Villela of Cannondale. Alexandre Genies of Francais du Jour got across. There was an eight-man group that were away. They didn't get a huge...
AG2R.
Sorry.
Did you also make a lot of mistakes yesterday, Lionel, in the tail at the Tapper?
Word spread.
Yeah, unconfirmed reports that yesterday's tail of the Tapper was far from flawless.
Riddled with mistakes. You aim for 60%. I think you're on about 40 at the moment.
I think the only major omission was that Nibali had gained a little bit of time. That was all, really. But in my defence, I'd had a snooze and I had two glasses of wine. I mean, surely that's fine. Anyway, Alexandre Genies of AG2R. He was Francais du Jour, wasn't he, when he won a stage here? But
that was Chris Froome was Barlow World. It's not okay to say that in the tail of the Tapper.
Okay. But didn't he win stage three of the Vuelta last year? I mean, doesn't matter. Let's carry on. Anyway, they were away. When they went over the Col de la Rabassa, it was Villela and Genies together, but they all got caught because there was quite a lot of action behind, ignited by Chris Froome. There was an intermediate sprint where Chris Froome actually pinched a couple of seconds, and we were talking, Rich, weren't we, about, you know, why did no one else sort of anticipate that and try and stop him from pinching those seconds? We'll maybe talk about that a little bit later on. But the day belonged to the Shark, Vincenzo Nibali. He won. He did quite an eccentric celebration as he crossed the line. He held his hand up to his cycling helmet in the manner, well, to basically signify a shark's fin, I guess. Either that or well, I don't know what.
Some compared him to a chicken.
Somebody did compare him to a chicken. A turkey.
The turkey.
Anyway, that was Nibali's first stage win at the Vuelta, which is quite surprising considering he won the race in 2010. He did actually get retrospectively given a stage win in 2010 after Ezequiel Mosquera tested positive. It completes his set of stage wins in all three Grand Tours, of course. Second was David de la Cruz, third Chris Froome, and then really the GC riders were stacking up behind, apart from poor old Alberto Contador, who got dropped when Gianni Moscon of Sky was setting the pace on the penultimate climb. So, yeah, sorry.
In Andorra.
On stage three.
Thank you. My fact checkers here. Contador was dropped at some point today, and he lost 2 minutes and 33 seconds. He finished a place ahead of Rafał Majka, another surprise, losing time on a stage like this. So Chris Froome is in the red jersey. It's the first time he's held it since 2011 when he had it for a day. Nibali is in the green jersey. Villela is in the King of the Mountains jersey.
Adam Yates has the best young rider number. He's supposed to come to the mix zone when he has that to do interviews after the finish, but didn't much fancy it, didn't make an appearance. I mean, it's a bit of a damp squib from his point of view. He's had so many best young riders jerseys now in so many different races, hasn't he? And then when they turn around and tell him that all he's getting is a fancy race number.
Fran had some insight on that, because I asked him about that, why there isn't a best young rider jersey in the Vuelta, and there never has been.
Well, there has been a young rider jersey on the Vuelta, but it was in the past century, so nobody remembers about that. This year, the AS newspaper was pushing for there to be a best young rider jersey in this edition of the race, but apparently there is an unlimited amount of jersey than a race can award, and the combined classification jersey, which should be the one replaced by the best young rider jersey, is sponsored by a long-standing sponsor of the race, Fertiberia. And apparently Fertiberia wants to keep that combined jersey on. Reason is that they want the main rider, a star rider who is fighting for the GC, to wear their logo. They are very happy of having this picture of Contador winning in the Fuente de stage in the Vuelta 2012. With the Fertiberia logo on the chest. So, yeah.
It's a great shame, especially at the Vuelta, which is a sort of almost a development Grand Tour. There are 60-odd under-25 riders, 61 riders, I think, who would have been eligible for it. So it's a real shame that this, of all the three Grand Tours, doesn't have a best young rider jersey.
Yeah, especially because it is replaced by a competition that, by its own nature, it's can be fought, actually, you know, because you are going, the guy riding for the GC is going to get points at the for the points classification, points from the motor classifications, and in the end he's going to be high in the standings of the combined classification, but it is not an aim for him.
I must say that on the eve of the Vuelta, as you spoke to riders, none of them said that they were aiming for the combined jersey. It's not, as you say, it would be impossible to go for it, wouldn't it? It's just...
I actually remember one Cajarura rider, Luis Mas, who aimed for to wear the combined classification jersey at some point in the earlier stages of the Vuelta a España, a couple or 3 years ago, but he got to wear the mountain jersey for 11 days, so he didn't never get to actually wear the combined classification jersey.
Oh, dear. Well, listen, I have to... Lionel's not the only one making mistakes at this Vuelta, because last night I thought that this would be a stage very like Etna at the Giro, too early for the real big guns to come out fighting, shooting, whatever. But they did. I mean, it was a really aggressive stage, you know, and Team Sky obviously wanted to make it hard. They really took it on. They helped bring the break back, made it really hard. Jenny Moscon was incredible on that climb. I mean, of all the riders on Team Sky, he'd have thought would have been setting the pace on that quite steep climb. You know, you put him behind Wout Poels, Nieve, but Wout Poels was actually dropped today. So an amazing performance from him. And as you said, Lionel, Contador went off the back when Gianni Moscon was on the front. Remarkable. And it was aggressive. I don't know. I mean, you didn't join us last night, Daniel. Did you expect that? Were you surprised by just how much happened today?
I got the vibe from Chris Froome this morning talking to him that they were going to be very aggressive. He said he was going to test his legs today. The one surprise for me as regards Sky's performance was Poels. Yesterday it was noticeable that Froome talks about how it was important to keep Poels up there on general classification. And, you know, I know in the team they have, well, certainly envisaged Poels being very high up on general classification, maybe right throughout the race, and perhaps giving them a second card to play or a contingency plan should anything happen to Froome. He's been in really good form. But Wout Poels has never really ridden a good general classification. He's in a major tour. He's never lasted the distance on general classification, so perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised. The Sky, the pace they set and how strong they were, I wasn't so surprised about that. We see them do that in a lot of races. We've seen them do it in the last month, even in races like Vuelta a Burgos. Gianni Moscon was extremely strong there on some very, very difficult climbs. With Moscon, it's going to be interesting over the next couple of years just to see what they do with him, because I think they're really between two stalls. Is he going to be a general classification rider? Is he going to be a classics rider? At the moment, it looks as though he can be pretty good in both departments, but I think he has the body to ride general classification. I think, will probably come down to his motivation.
The build, you think? Because he's quite muscular.
It reminds me a little bit of Teish Benoot at Lotto. He's another rider who I think is a bit undecided about which direction his career is going to go in. But, you know, you look at the kind of general classification riders that seem to be flourishing at the moment. Tom Dumoulin, we think, although he'd had a pretty indifferent performance today, Bob Jungels. You know, with time trials paradoxically becoming more and more important as there are fewer and fewer kilometres against the clock because it's closer and closer in the mountains, it's going to be guys who are good in time trials if... You know, this trend continues, really, of everything getting closer and closer together. The one place you can make up time is time trials. And Moscon, you would think, although he hasn't had fantastic results thus far in his career in time trials, you would think that's an area in which he will really develop.
Yeah, Chris Froome made the point in the press conference afterwards that every second counts, because he lost a Vuelta in 2011 when Juan José Cobo of Geox won the race. Bradley Wiggins, of course, was the team leader there, and Froome was kind of the surprise man of the race. Had the red jersey for a day after a good performance in a time trial, and then lost it when the racing got a bit more kind of gnarly and unpredictable, but finished very strongly, particularly with the steep uphill climbs. But when you look at the GC at the moment, 2 seconds to De La Cruz, Roach and Van Garder, and that's not, you know, not too much to worry about, but 10 seconds to Nibali, 11 to Chavez, and then a bit of a gap to Aru at 38. You know, today will go down. He was asked, Chris Froome, in the press conference, whether he expected more, from today for the efforts that he made going for the intermediate sprint as well, and then trying to drop everybody and then it all coming back together. Would he feel disappointed? But I actually don't think he should feel disappointed, because it's about getting his nose in front with the time trial in Navarra, which will really, you know, play to his strength. Today has to go down as a really good day for him and Team Sky, and definitely in contrast to last year where they tried to kind of ride the Vuelta just on the shoulders of other people, here they are riding the Vuelta like it's the Tour de France.
Riding to win, and I wondered when I saw Froome go for that 3 second bonus with about 12 kilometres to the finish, a very odd place to have an intermediate sprint. I thought when it was only him that went for it, I thought, do any of the guys want to win the race? Because it could be decided by a very small margin. What we're seeing, though, is Froome being set up to attack, attacking, and not dropping everybody. I mean, Chavez was perhaps a surprise package today. He went with Froome, and Froome said afterwards in a press conference that Chavez was the rider that he was most surprised by it and felt was a danger because he rode extremely well today. And as it happens, I spoke to him at the start this morning for a kilometre zero that we've got coming up this week about Lucho Herrera's win in the Vuelta in 1987, 30 years ago, the great Colombian climber, first ever Colombian to win a Grand Tour. So I spoke to Chavez about him, but I also asked him how he's been getting on so far in the race. So this was Chavez speaking at the start this morning.
Esteban, you've started the Vuelta very well. You rode a good team time trial, and even you're up there yesterday.
Yeah, it's the stage two, and it's really well, but we have 19 in front, so we can't say nothing.
You're looking forward to it, though. Do you feel in good form? You've obviously had a difficult season this year. How are you coming into this Vuelta?
I come in like more relaxed after the Tour, actually. Looking for what? Obviously, I won't feel again like last year, climb on the front, but you never know. We are no robots. A lot of things we can't control. We try to always the maximum we can, and the more important is enjoy the race and enjoy the moment, enjoy the guys in the bus, enjoy all this crowd, and this is the more important. And last year we try for the race.
And enjoy the Colombian support, always a lot of Colombian support.
Yeah, exactly.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our main sponsor. And I should say a couple of things about Rafa. One is that they are publishing a daily diary from Lachlan Morton, who's riding the race for Dimension Data. It's his first Grand Tour. So look out for that, it's really good. And it'll be interesting how he gets on as the race gets hillier and tougher. And also they've just released a film, Abrazos, about Colombian cycling. And we heard before the break from Esteban Chavez, and I have to say one of the highlights of the film is the interview with Chavez's parents, especially his mother, who becomes very emotional talking about watching her son race. And it's fantastic, and I really highly recommend it. You can watch it if you go to rafa.cc. You can find all this stuff. Lucho Herrera, I mentioned earlier, he is in the film as well. It's a real under the skin of Colombian cycling. Speaks to a few of the old legends. And I asked Chavez about it this morning if he'd watched it, and he said, "Of course, of course." And you know, he loves it, and he loves the fact his parents are in it. And he said his parents are coming out for the final week of the Vuelta, and he said that his mother does always get very, very emotional watching him race. So it's well worth watching. Really, a really good film. Sorry, Lionel.
Well, I was going to
stuck your hand up.
Well, I was going to ask Daniel why he was mocking me with his face and eyes just before we broke up there.
I was going to ridicule Lionel again because I was pretty sure that the final time trial of the Vuelta was not in Navarra and it was in Rioja, but apparently it does start in Navarra and finishes in Rioja, so
Lionel's punching the air.
It starts on the motor racing circuit, doesn't it, in Nevada, and then goes to Logroño, which is in Rioja, where I should be drinking some Rioja before doing the tail of the Etapa that day.
Easy on the Rioja, Lionel. It's holiday Lionel, Vuelta Lionel. I don't know, I mean, there are three Lionels. There's Giro Lionel, Tour Lionel, Vuelta Lionel. We've certainly got holiday Lionel here. But Chavez, today, he had a very poor, he's had a difficult year with injury, with the death of his personal physiotherapist just before the Tour, and then a very difficult Tour. You know, he didn't look in good shape at the Tour. I remember the stage to Cherche Valley. He got on the break that day. It was one of the only days we saw him, and he was dropped quite early from a big group, and it didn't look good for him at all. But, you know,
the results, the performances so far in the team time trial, in the crosswinds, and today going with Froome, suggests that he's in very good form, and we might see him in the sort of form he was in last year.
Yeah, indeed, Rich. And I think, well, I was quite surprised to see him there today following Froome, the only guy who was able to follow Froome on the climbs. I think he was swinging, he was holding on a little bit towards the top. But at the finish, he said it felt great to be a general classification rider again. He'd obviously missed that at the Tour de France. And you know, these guys are so sort of disposable in the moment. It struck me during the Tour de France that he was finishing stages and he was just meandering through the crowds to the bus. No one was trying to interview him. And he became a real irrelevance in the second and third week. And he was, you know, he was obviously struggling emotionally and physically. And I know Orica gave him the option of going home. And he said no, he wanted to carry on and fight. But he seemed a forlorn figure towards the end of the Tour de France. And there, Director Sportifs Matt White in particular thought that he should stay, that he needed to stay, that he hadn't had enough racing this year. And yeah, it seems to have been a good decision. He's obviously trained hard in the last month or so since the Tour de France, and I don't see him threatening Froome too much with that 40 kilometer time trial coming in Logroño, partly in Navarra, partly in Rioja. But he will be a factor. And the Yateses were slightly disappointing today. They lost time. So I don't think we can necessarily rely on Simon to provide a third option for Orica and, you know, to be able to play a sort of game of poker with those three. But they have nonetheless got a very strong team.
Chavez is so deceptively cherubic, we say it all the time, but he's really tough. I mean, you know, he finished on the podium at the Giro and the Vuelta last year. He won a fantastic Tour Lombardy, which was maybe his best performance of the season. It's very easy, I think, to underestimate him, isn't it? Because the smile sort of lights up a room and can deceive you a little bit. But what's interesting about him is, well, one, that he did finish the Tour, that he wasn't in great shape physically or mentally, as you say, but he got through it. And I think that's probably been very important in terms of the form that he's brought to the Vuelta. And the other thing is just the sort of depth of loyalty I think he has to that team, to Orica. I mean, when I asked him to introduce himself this morning, he described himself as half Australian. You know, there's a real sense in that team. And I think you've said it before, Daniel, this Vuelta could be the test of that. It's the first time we've seen all those three riders, the Yates twins and Chavez, riding together, in theory, all with a chance of leading the team. They've got such a good spirit in that team, and this could test that. This could be the real test of whether that will stand, two of them perhaps being in contention. But the chances of all three of them being in contention was always pretty slim. And as you said, Adam Yates and Simon Yates just lost a little bit of time today. Not an awful lot. They're still there. But that's the Orica challenge, is one of the things I'm most looking forward to in this race.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Daniel, you said, you know, what can Adam and Simon Yates do? At the moment, Chavez is just that sort of few millimetres ahead of the other two, based purely on today's stage. But what will be really fascinating is whether they go for broke with one of the Yates twins and decide to really try and upset the apple cart. I mean, we've said this so many times, when Sky are so strong, they've got that stranglehold, they've got six or seven riders, and I mean, although they fell away relatively quickly, they still had a strong presence, got Chris Froome to a very good position where he could then put in that move and accelerate and open up the gaps. I mean, you know, they were putting the pressure on. Orica have got strength in numbers, and we always think if you've got strength in numbers, then you've got to play that to your advantage rather than trying to get them all round to Madrid roughly, you know, a couple of minutes apart from one another. They could really do something dramatic. Whether they do that or not, you know, we'll have to wait and see, but we're crying out for that kind of sort of tactical manoeuvre, aren't we?
Be reminded the stage of the Vuelta last year in Andorra. That day was a master plan by Orica and Movistar also. Movistar didn't sadly deliver because Alejandro Valverde wasn't as strong as they thought he was, but for Orica, it was a cracker. They have a really good sense of strategy, one where every rider has a mission and is always, does actually feels the wind on his face. You know, one where every rider is useful and gives his best at the best moment in order to take the best result. So I am confident that with these three riders in good shape, they can deliver very good emotions.
And Rich, we haven't had any football analogies thus far, and we're already in part two, so I better get one in. Orica, they're a counter-attacking team, aren't they? They're a gegenpressing kind of team. Sky, they play the tiki-taka. They like to have 70% possession, 80% possession. Orica sit back, they park the bus, they absorb the pressure, and then they come to the fore. They only really, you only really see them when they are launching attacks and launching those tactical manoeuvres like we saw on the Obisque last year, like we saw in the penultimate stage of the Vuelta. So, yeah, I'm sure we'll see more of that later in the Vuelta.
And that, I mentioned already, the sort of closeness between them, which will be tested. But there's an honesty. I think, you know, much is made of the fact that the Yates brothers are twins. But, you know, they've grown up, I guess, having empathy for another rider as good as them. And you know, that's sometimes difficult for a rider to deal with. And you get the impression that at Sky that, you know, Froome is very much, there's such a hierarchy there that Froome's the undisputed leader. You mentioned Wout Poels earlier. Rod Ellingworth, the race coach, the other day told me that he thought he would finish on the podium. But it would be very much an afterthought with Froome the undisputed leader.
Very quick one. This is a question I asked a colleague the other day. If at this point in their careers you had to put your money behind one of the Yates brothers, who would it be?
To do what?
Well, you have to invest in one of them to be the better rider, to have the better palmarès, the better career.
Oh, that's a really difficult one. There was a feature in Pro Cycling recently. I can't remember whether it was Ed Pickering or Sam Dancy. I think it was Sam, where he really went through what they'd done, and it's almost impossible to prize them apart. Simon Yates looks like he might be the better one day racer. Adam Yates the better stage racer, but then again, Adam Yates has won a classic. He's won San Sebastian. Yeah. I don't know. I think.
Wow, that's some thinking.
I think.
You can see the cog. You can see the cogs going round, Richard. Come on, one name: Adam or Simon. Adam.
I think Adam. I think Adam, but I think Simon will do something. You know, I think he'll have. I think he's got a big result in him as well. But I think Adam. Well, if one of them's to win a Grand Tour, I think it would be Adam. What do you think?
I think that they are slightly, they're always slightly disconcerted by how, to the extent to which they're confused. And I think, you know, we think of them as kind of punchy, explosive riders, both of them. And for example, at the Dauphiné, I can't remember, was it the Dauphiné or the Tour de France? There was a short, sharp finish. And I sort of said to Simon, well, you know, this was your kind of finish. He said, well, not really. Everyone thinks that I'm that kind of rider. And I think they get me confused with Adam in that respect. And I'm not really that kind of rider. I'm better on the longer climbs. I think Simon, I think psychology will play a part as well. I think Simon is probably slightly more relaxed. But that could be, that can be an advantage or it could be a disadvantage. I would agree with you, Rich. I think maybe Adam ultimately is going to do better in Grand Tours. And Simon maybe will win more stages of Grand Tours and maybe win more one-day races. I think he's slightly faster, isn't he?
Well, you say that about Simon. He won that stage in Dartmoor in the Tour of Britain 1 year on a very short, sharp climb against a fantastic field. They're both, I think Simon's maybe a slightly better time trialist as well. I mean, Simon's a more than decent time trialist, which you forget. They're both very slight riders. But it's you know, the way that they've developed, and Orica, Scott, deserve a lot of credit for the way they've brought them along. And you know, just every year has been incremental progress, hasn't it? It's very impressive to watch. But there will come a moment when, I guess, you know, they'll go into a race and maybe have to choose who they're going to back.
To be honest, my concern with the Yates brothers is that I don't see a personality building in them. You know, their charisma, at least from my perception, is so low. You know, they don't have a gimmick. They don't have dimensions as characters.
Yeah, I see parallels with Robert Miller, who was a rider in the 80s. You're far too young to remember him. He was interesting, but not to the journalists who were there at the time. They're the same. They don't say much, but they're interesting to observe. There's a strength and there's a in the fact that they say so little, that makes them quite interesting. Chris Froome says a lot and it's not that interesting. They say very little, and that actually, I think, makes them kind of interesting.
I would agree. It's kind of fascinating to observe them, particularly Adam, in a generation and at a time when, you know, even a lot of bike riders, we've talked about this, are kind of consumed by what social media and, you know, and also the social side of being in the peloton. They all, you know, we've got these big communities in cycling of Girona and Andorra and Nice, and it's, you know, it is quite a social business. I always find it intriguing to watch Adam before the start of a stage. He's one of the few guys who will consistently, and when the riders line up for the start, he will hang back and he tries to immerse himself in his own world, and he gets very focused. And I think he loves that aspect of his job, getting really, really focused. Whereas, you know, a lot of riders, you'll see them chit-chatting away, and they almost try to abstract themselves from the pressure and the stresses of their job, whereas Adam seems to relish that. And I think Simon's probably the same. And, you know, they're not ones for social media. They don't, you know, they do interviews, and they're getting better at them, and they express themselves better and better off, you know, with every major tour. But they don't see that as core to what they do. They're pure racers and real professionals.
Their in-race personas are so kind of neutral. They're almost like a blank canvas, aren't they? Whereas when a couple of winters ago now, went up to Lancashire and met them in a cafe and talked, and I was kind of dreading it, really, because they'd given me short shrift in interviews at races over the course of that year. That was their big breakthrough year. I'm thinking, this could be like getting blood out of a stone. But actually, they were away from races in November time, just preparing to go off for a bit of a holiday. They were completely different characters. And I think it's dangerous sometimes to kind of assume that the people that are here at the bike race is exactly what they're like, you know, as human beings. And and I think they have grown in kind of confidence, and they are you know, they've grown into these roles here. And I mean, when you see what the results are so consistent, that's the other thing about them. I mean, you know, you have to go back, I think, 3 years now for them not to have had a top 10 in one of the Grand Tours. So as commodities in the sport, fantastic kind of you know, value to them without having really any kind of media profile.
I agree. I think they're fascinating, and I'm glad you mentioned your friend special, Lionel. That came out 2015. You can still sign up as a friend for 2015 at thecyclingpodcast.com. And a reminder that Kilometer Zero at the Vuelta is for friends of the podcast. Become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. We released our first one of the Vuelta today. It was a story of Aqua Blue Sport debut on Saturday in the team time trial. Spoke to various people on the team, including the team owner, Rick Delaney. It was really interesting to speak to them before and after, because there was a lot of apprehension, nerves, and relief as soon as the race was over. So, reminder that you can listen to all our 9 episodes of Kilometer Zero by becoming a friend of the podcast.
Listen to Kilometer Zero, our morning show at the Vuelta a España, by becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. A reminder, 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code CPAUG20. CPAUG20, 20% off. I got a message from Hayden Groves today, who is riding his way around the Vuelta one day ahead of the race. His luggage still hasn't turned up, unfortunately, so I don't know how he's doing it. They're riding in a group of 5. I don't know if he's detached himself slightly, because if he's wearing the same clothing every day, it might be quite unpleasant for his colleagues, who include Geoff Thomas.
He could wash them in the shower or the bath like they used to in the old days. You mentioned Robert Miller in 1985, when he got diddled over by the Spaniards in the Vuelta on the penultimate day, I think. He would have been washing his jersey in the bath, wouldn't he, in those days?
There was a great story from the time, actually. Remember Face magazine went and did a big feature with Robert Miller, and one of the observations from the journalist was that the riders' hotel, the balconies, all had their race jerseys and their shorts. Now, who was it? One of the riders used to rinse his jersey in the toilet. He used to wash it in the sink. I think it might have been, I don't want to say who it was because I'll probably get it wrong, but was it Sean Kelly? No, maybe not. He used to wash his jersey and then put it in the toilet, flush it several times to rinse it.
Yeah, just a very quick one, a Sean Kelly laundry story. Sean Kelly, of course, won the race in 88, the Welter, that is. Would have probably won in 87 and denied Columbia that Grand Tour victory had it not been for a very painful saddle sore. Probably tell that story later in the race at some point. But the story about Sean Kelly and the laundry, again, relates to Spain because it was a Spanish race where they were staying in like an apartment block in somewhere in the south, I don't know, Benidorm or somewhere like that. And Eddie Plankert was staying like a couple of floors down, and Eddie Plankert's jersey and shorts were hanging on the line on the balcony, and Sean positioned his jersey and shorts directly above, so the water was dripping down, and Eddie Plankert was getting so wound up because his jersey and shorts weren't drying in time because the water was dripping onto them.
Oh dear. Well listen, we should talk again about today's stage, because there were winners and losers. Big winner was obviously Vincenzo Nibali, who appeared to be in trouble at points, but recovered, came back, won the stage. And Alberto Contador, I mean, Vincenzo Nibali, Daniel.
Yeah, I wondered how he would feel after today's stage win, because I thought it might be a bit bittersweet. He obviously has come into this Welter with big ambitions. He wants to match Chris Froome on the climbs. He didn't do that. He really struggled. He was one of the first big hitters to get dropped on the final climb. I asked him about that at the finish. He said, well, you know, he was quite a long way back when they got to the final climb. It was a big effort to get back up to Froome, and then he paid for that later. But I think it's a bit of a pattern with Nibali, particularly in the first big climb of major tours. And not only that, I remember at Abu Dhabi earlier on in the season, that the only big climb in that that race to Jebel Hafit, I think it's called, he was dropped as well. And it does seem to be a bit of a pattern. I think he'll draw comfort from the fact that in the Giro in the spring, he did come on quite strong in the latter part of the race. And, you know, there's a good reason, there's a reason for him having won, how many Grand Tours has he won now? Four. Two Giros and one Vuelta and one...
Tajiri, Daniel.
Oh, my word. Anyway, Rich is punching the air now. That will never happen again. Yeah, and he really is a master tradesman as far as Grand Tours are concerned. He's lost Javi Moreno. His team is not particularly strong. He has been disappointed, I think, with his team throughout the year. He's desperate for reinforcements next year. There have been some real teething problems, I think, with that team as far as Nibali is concerned. And I don't really see him as being a very credible challenger to Froome as far as winning the race is concerned. I think he'll probably ride a good race, and I think he could finish second or third, but I think he's still some way short of Froome at this point, and I think he needs to improve.
The thing about Nibali, I mean, the fact he comes on strong, or has come on strong in those two Giri in recent years, it's a kind of, you condense that down to how he performs in stages, and today he rode one stage a bit like he rode the Giro a couple of years ago. In you know, he looked out of it at one point, looked like he was struggling, but the closer he gets to the finish line, the stronger he seems to get, and that's mental strength, that's not just physical strength. As soon as the line is kind of in front of him, he's like a, well, he's like a shark, isn't he, scenting blood in the water. But the thing about it was that the way he opened the sprint up, he put everything on the line and opened the sprint up early and held it on. And when you've got those GC guys coming together, getting in front is it's not even three quarters of the battle. It's like 95% of the battle, because people coming from behind, you know, yes, obviously it's fast, but they're not pure sprinters. It's very easy for those guys to kind of misjudge the distance to the line. And Nibali got his nose in front and just held on and looked really good. And I think, like you say, Daniel, he will draw a lot of confidence from that, and he can afford to settle back in a little bit, just ride defensively for a bit. He doesn't need to take anything on. He certainly hasn't got a team that can challenge Team Sky here, but he will be dangerous, and he will probably, you know, lay it down on one particular day and cause Sky some difficulties, I guess.
I mean, I spoke to Joaquin Rodriguez, who, of course, works for the Bahrain Merida team this morning. He talks about the confidence that riders draw when they win a stage early and when they get a good result in early. So, and how that stands them in really good stead for the rest of the race. So Nibali has that, but I think 9 summit finishes to come in this Welter. Whichever way you look at it, it's going to be a test of climbing, a pure test of climbing, and a test of time trialing. And on the evidence of today, Nibali is inferior in both departments to Chris Froome.
That's the thing. I mean, I always think that Nibali is dangerous because of his racecraft. You know, he has shown time and again that he's aggressive and he's smart enough as to take any chance and make it useful for him, for his interest. But in this Vuelta, the distribution of the efforts and of the decisive segments is so skewed. The distribution of the decisive segments is so skewed towards the final. There are so many summit finishes where Chris Froome and every single rider that has a better weighted watts per kilo ratio than Nibali is going to outclimb him. So that is going to damage and handicap his options.
What I like about Nibali is, though, he will try and beat Froome. He will not follow him. He will not follow him to try and finish on the podium of this race. He's one of the few riders in the race who's won Grand Tours. Alberto Contador is another one. We'll talk about him in a moment. But Nibali is a guy. He's not gonna ride this well to try and finish on the podium. He's gonna try and beat him. He's gonna try and win it. He's gonna try and take every advantage he can. Perhaps, you know, we've spoken a lot this year about the unwritten rules. He'll try and take advantage of situations where, you know, others might not take advantage of them. We saw at the Tour, Froome almost being not gifted the win, but you felt that the riders behind him weren't trying to beat him, that they were trying to finish on the podium. Nibali won't do that, and that's refreshing. I mentioned Contador. I mean, disappointing day for him today. And you, I think, spoke to him, or you were in a group speaking to him at the finish, Fran.
Well, today at the finish line, the mood was a bit grumpy. I don't know what was the reason, if it was transfer or whatever, but the mood was overall a bit grumpy. And when Alberto Contador made it to the finish line, all the Spanish cycling journals were, to some extent, devastated. Because even if we were aware, we as a group were aware that he is in a decay and he is losing strength as the days go by, it wasn't expected that he was going to lose 3 minutes. And especially in this harming way of seeing him dropped so early by Sky's third to last, Jaume Stig, to lose 3 minutes, being struggling to be on the wheel of an average domestic such as Peter Stettina. This was harming for the Spanish narrative of this race.
Tell you who impressed me today, Roman Bardet. Really impressed me to finish fourth. And also, you know, not only to be content to have got back on and got back in touch with the leaders, but then also to have given it a go in the sprint. It shows that all his talk of coming here for an adventure, he made it sound as though it was a camping holiday.
Like Lionel.
I think he really means business. And what we said about Nibali and it being a pure test of climbing and us not necessarily being that confident in Nibali matching Froome on the climbs, that doesn't apply to Bardet. I think Bardet can go toe-to-toe with Froome on the climbs. Certainly can't in the time trial, of course.
Well, he's done a good job of taking pressure off himself, hasn't he? And we'll see. And maybe that's his strategy. Maybe, you know, he wants to just see how it goes. He's not really backed up like this before. So looking forward to seeing. It was good to see several riders come to the finish together. And it was a hard stage, but the gaps are not huge. Froome looks to be very strong. Like I said earlier, he wasn't able to drop everybody like we've seen in the past.
Yeah, I think what Daniel said about the summit finishes, where Fran backed up about the summit finishes, is absolutely right. These were racing climbs, weren't they? They were speed and kind of, you know, hitting them hard, and the tempo was high from the bottom to the top, encouraging climbs for attacking, rather than a kind of real war of attrition sort of climbs that we'll see a bit later on. But it was an interesting. You know, interesting to see who's hot and who's not, and that's what the first kind of uphill, the first kind of climbing stages of the race are about. And now we have a flat stage tomorrow, and everyone can kind of calm down a bit, and then it's sort of hilly and lumpy and what have you before, you know, we get to a bit more climbing towards the weekend, I think.
Finally, before we end tonight, second time we've been in Andorra in the last year or so. We were in Andorra for the Tour last year. We shared a hotel last year with Movistar, and we're sharing a hotel again tonight with Movistar. We had Marc Soler sitting at the table next to us when we started this podcast. But Movistar had a shocker today. You know, for Spain's big team in the national tour, they had a terrible day, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, but this is what Movistar is at the moment. I mean, with Alejandro Valverde out of contention and Nairo Quintana at home, Movistar does not have on its roster another rider on the level to be on that 10-man group that played for the victory. Dani Moreno is the best option for the overall classification, but we are talking of an option for a top 10, maybe, not more.
I mean, do you know how bad Movistar's day was? There isn't even any Movistar network in Andorra. Usually we get, when we're on the Vuelta, you can pick up some Movistar network. I've got none on my phone.
Well, that just says it all, doesn't it, really? I think on that note, sorry, Lionel.
Well, I was just going to say, Carlos Betancourt, 1:14 down. You'd have thought he'd do a bit better than that, really. I mean, could surely have been in that front group, really, given that there's no one else in the team. You know, he could have ridden himself up and given himself...
No. I expect...
He did so well at the Hammer Series. Maybe if they'd done just laps of Andorra, he'd have been brilliant.
I expected more of Marc Soler, better voice. I don't know if he's still within earshot, but I expected more of him as well.
You know, before Marc Soler, do you want to hear a Pondlet's anecdote on Carlos Betancourt? Yeah. So Carlos Betancourt recently issued on a press release sent by his own agency, he said that he had just realized how important weight is for performance. That before, he had never thought of it because he won whatever his weight was. But nowadays, Eusebio Unzue has convinced him of how important it is to be actually... to weigh actually what a cyclist should weigh. And the other day, I was speaking to him at the start, and he was refusing all the carers of Movistar team that were asking him to carry some food. He refused that, saying, no, I have an energy bar, and that's enough for the race. Maybe I will pick a banana later. And because he said that I only need natural carbohydrates.
Carlos, with the code CPAUG20 at scienceandsport.com, you can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products. And I think that's maybe what you were lacking today, a little caffeine gel before the final climb.
Yeah, before anyone else says it, you know, about people's weight. I mean, you know, I sympathise with Carlos there because, you know, it's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult on a Grand Tour to turn down a meal, and there's so much coming at you, and you're worried about tomorrow and where the next meal might come from. So you just stock up, don't you? But I just think back to Paris-Nice when Betancourt was absolutely brilliant. I mean, there was this climb up to Fayence, which was so steep, and he looked brilliant. I mean, I stood right by the side of the road, and I just thought, this guy has got so much talent. And I think, I was flipping about the Hammer Series there, but, you know, repeated climbing efforts on that day, that was a real brutal race, and he smashed it. And so when you come here... And you see a kind of, you know, this is a kind of the gradual winding up type of racing. And I wonder whether, you know, on some level, perhaps it's kind of too boring for him. Maybe it just needs to be more explosive. And
I think he should just embrace the food, beef up, and go for the points race on the track. I think he'd be brilliant at that. Anyway, let's wind things up for tonight. Fran, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And we look forward to more singing. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.